Tonight, I want to begin with looking at, the first thing is just the person called wisdom in Proverbs, just to show it to you. I've got some verses written down. We'll read through that. And then we're going to look at Isaiah, eschatology in the book of Isaiah. And, well, first of all, you know, Isaiah was right around the time of Hosea, and northern Israel fell in 722. So Isaiah was prophesying before that time. We could even say like 730 B.C. And so he's going to be doing a lot of prophesying about northern Israel and the coming Assyrians, but mainly focused on Judah in the south, because that's where he's at. And he's moving amongst the kings down there in the palace. In fact, they found the bulle, or a bulla with his signature from his ring in it, or his seal, very close to where they found Hezekiah. So we found where his documents were, where they got burnt, and they found the clay seal. I should have probably got a replica of it. I should have brought that up here. So he's got prophecy about this time period. But Isaiah also projects further into the future, into the eschatological time period where we're talking about. So as you go through Isaiah, we'll look at that to see it. But it's a lot of it we'll just skip because it's prophecy to the people at that time and it was fulfilled. But yet then he projects on into the future. But in Proverbs, beginning in Proverbs chapter 1, you can see right there, I'm just going to read through these verses. Not all of them, of course, but the person wisdom, and you can take this as a figurative way of speaking, you know, it's a personification of wisdom. But as you look at this, and as we conclude the book of Proverbs, wisdom seems to be, you know, the second member of the Trinity himself, you know, the Son of God. So we're in, and again, you can take and think about that. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 20 is where I'm just going to begin. And you can see it's here, it's the person. It says, wisdom calls aloud in the street. She raises her voice in the public squares. At the head of the noisy streets, she cries out. In the gateways of the city, she makes her speech. How long will you simple ones love your simple ways? How long will mockers delight in mockery? And it goes on, you can see how he's calling, or wisdom here personified as a woman calling in the streets to people. And so it's almost like a person, a being that is in creation itself that's calling to mankind. We go on in chapter 2, verse 12. Wisdom says, will save you from the ways of the wicked men, for men whose words are perverse, who leave the straight paths to walk in dark ways, who delight in doing wrong and rejoice in the perverseness of evil, whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways. It will save you from the adulteress and the wayward wife with her seductive words, who has left her partner of her youth. It goes through and talks about wisdom being able to do that for you. Chapter 3, verse 13. Blessed is the man who finds wisdom, the man who gains understanding. For she is more profitable than silver and yields a better return than gold. She's more precious than rubies. So this is all the things that wisdom does. Go to chapter 8. And chapter 8 begins, does not wisdom call out? Does not understanding raise her voice on the heights along the way? Similar to what we saw calling out, you know, in the streets. But when it begins in verse 22 and then says this, verse 12. I, wisdom, dwell together with prudence. I possess knowledge and discretion. So there's I, wisdom. And then in verse 22, the Lord brought me forth as the first of his works. Before his deeds of old, I was appointed from eternity. From the beginning, before the world began, when there were no oceans, I was given birth. Now again, don't stumble on that. When there was no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled in place, before hills, I was given birth. Before he made the earth or its fields or any of the dust of the world, I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked the horizons on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed securely the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundaries so the waters would not overstep his command, and when he marked out the foundation of the earth, then I was the craftsman at his side. Not only there, wisdom wasn't that, but the craftsman, and this would line up with Colossians. You go to Colossians and we see Christ being or Jesus being the creator. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoiced always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in mankind. Now, with that idea, it gives that impression that wisdom was there in the beginning, if it's just the concept of wisdom, but you've got a person, it seems like that. And then we go to the end of Proverbs. This is kind of what I wanted to read. And it answers a question about, you know, who if anybody else wrote this. But Proverbs 30, it says right here, the sayings of Augur, son of Jacca, an oracle. So this is something, you know, another author, and there's many authors put together here. This man declared to Ithiel and to Euchel, he says, I am the most ignorant of men. I do not have a man's understanding. I have not learned wisdom. So this now is someone that doesn't know wisdom. Almost like a contrast. This is a person that doesn't know wisdom. I have not learned wisdom, nor have I knowledge of the Holy One. Who has gone up to heaven and come down? See, it goes, so who has gone up to heaven and come down to back to the earth? Who has gathered up the wind in the hollow of his hands? So now here it is, you know, the gathering up the wind. This goes back to the idea of the creator who can take creation and hold it, who can control it. Who has wrapped up the waters in his cloak? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name and the name of his son? Tell me if you know. So there's a person right there who says, I do not know wisdom. I'm ignorant. Who can tell me about what's in heaven? Who can tell me all these things? What is his name and the name of his son? So, and then it goes on, it says, every word of God is flawless, and he is a shield of those who take refuge in him. And that's kind of how the book ends right there. And there's there's more coming up there. But anyway, just the idea that wisdom, if we're talking about eschatology and, you know, Christ, we see him coming as the king, we see him coming as the seed of David, the seed of woman. Now we see him possibly as this wisdom. And throughout the book of Proverbs, it's like, if you want life, you've got to have wisdom. If you want anything, you've got to have this wisdom. And it's trying to proclaim itself to the world, and the ignorance of man continues to block it. And this is, again, just interesting to see that in Proverbs. So I just wanted to point that out to you, that there, especially when you see that question about what is his name, who's gone up to heaven, who's come down, what is his son's name? So even in the Old Testament there in Proverbs, you've got this ideal of a deity, you know, God, Yahweh, you know, and then his son, it's his representative, it's wisdom. He's at his side at creation. He's helping at creation. And it's just like, you know, even in the talks about in the garden, when it talks about God in the plural, let us go down and look, let us go see these things. There's just something interesting happening, especially when you get into eschatology, where you're going to see in Isaiah, where you're going to see the suffering servant is going to come, and he's going to do God's will or the Lord's will. So it goes back to like we saw last week, where Jesus says, you know, if the Messiah is David's son, how can he call him Lord if he's his son? And they couldn't figure that out, because the ideal is there. You do have, you know, this God that you've never seen that is in heaven, but you have this manifestation of this God that is exactly God. We call it the Son. Proverbs maybe calls it wisdom. It's the seed of David. It's the Son of David who's going to become, and we're going to see it. Well, we saw it yesterday, like in Colossians, where he, you know, the fullness of deity, the fullness of deity in flesh. It's 100% God, but 100% man. This is going to be the Christ, the Messiah. And so you can see that throughout the Old Testament, then this is the Son, the second member of the Trinity, that is appearing to Adam and Eve, is appearing to Noah, Abraham, Moses at the burning bush, is becomes the pillar of fire in the cloud. It's the Shekinah glory. It's God manifested any time in history. No one's seen God, but they see this manifestation, which is the second member of the Trinity. And that's going to become the Christ. Now, in Isaiah, I want to go through this, and again, you can see I've got on this first and second page, I've got a lot of verses, and we're going to read through. We'll see. I mean, right, what we're looking at right here is a very, you know, just short notes compared to other nights. But what we're looking at is 66 chapters of the book of Isaiah, and so we're looking at probably a three-year Bible study. Obviously, that's not our intention. But I want to point out, as we go through this, and again, our target is to teach eschatology, but instead of going to Revelation and Thessalonians and picking out all the favorite verses and putting them together, and starting at the end, we're starting at the beginning and just building up, putting things together. So when we get there, you kind of have some limitations. You kind of have some basis of interpreting what is taking place. And so Isaiah now is a prophet who's going to be coming around 730 BC. He's going to continue on into the 600s, into the days of Hezekiah. He is living at a time, along with Hosea, Amos, they overlapped. But you've got Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea. That's kind of a big Sea of Galilee. That makes it more accurate. There we go. Here's the border. Here's Jerusalem. Here's the northern kingdom of Israel. Up here to the north, as this is right out of Tuesday nights or any time you study this time period, you've got the Arameans up here, Aram, of course, Syria, and north of that is the Assyrians. And during this century, the Assyrians became very weak around 760 during Jonah's time, but Jonah went and prophesied, and they began to recover. And they eventually come down and attack the Arameans and put pressure on the northern border of Israel. Now, during this time period, Isaiah begins to prophesy. Isaiah begins to prophesy in Judah to the kings. And so he's addressing what's taking place here. What's going to happen is the king of the Arameans and the king of Israel are going to put pressure on Judah and the king, Hezekiah's father, to join them in an attack on Assyria. And Isaiah is going to come and tell the king, don't do it. Don't worry about it. God is going to take care of this. And then he's going to give him a prophecy during this time. He says, this Damascus will no longer be a city, and this land will no longer be a country by the time this child is 12 years old. And you'll see it. That's the verse about the virgin having a child. And that's going to be an important verse here, and eschatologically. The king doesn't listen to him and panics and goes up and actually makes a treaty with the Assyrians trying to override this and get some help. And he's actually going to help pay the Assyrians to come down and attack the Arameans and set this whole stage up, putting Hezekiah, his son, in a position where he's got to pay tribute to the Assyrians. It basically increases their taxes. Isaiah's talking very specifically about this time period, but over all this, he's talking about the future, the distant future. So when we're reading through this, I'm going to skip all these verses in many cases and go to the places where he's talking into the future. So we begin on the top there, Isaiah chapter 2. And here is the first reference here of eschatology, chapter 2. And this is, we talked last week, I believe it was, about the place. One of the things that we've talked about, you know, we've got the Davidic covenant, we've got, you know, the promise of the king, we've got the promise of the land, we've got the promise of the seed of the woman coming, but also we saw that God is going to choose the place. And the place that he chose and was referenced often in the book of Psalms is the place is going to be called Zion. It's the place where God's going to put his name. It's where he's going to put his temple. He wants all the worship here. And that is what David did, Solomon did, and now they're continuing to worship here. This northern kingdom went up here and put a place in Bethel and a place in Dan where the golden calf was and wouldn't let the people go down here to Jerusalem. They created their own worship system in rebellion towards the place. But this is not just something that's an Old Testament place. It says here, chapter 2, we got beginning in verse 1, this is what Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now here's a phrase. In the last days, and you got to be careful, you can't just make this automatic, but in many cases, it's like a warning sign, it's like a flag. In the last days, it's talking about the last days, the distant days, or the eschatological days. Not these days, Isaiah's prophesying about these events to the king. He's actually a consular. He's actually a prophet, potentially on the payroll, but he's one that maintained his integrity. A lot of times the prophets, especially up here, they'd go on the payroll of the king, and then they'd say positive things to the king, and they'd stay on the payroll. It's like the false news. It's like you can lie on the media. You can have the false news, and it looks good. Everybody likes you and supports you, but none of it's going to come true. That's not even what's happening, and eventually they're going to be eliminated from history. That's what happened to these prophets. Isaiah, in a sense, would be someone that was on the payroll, and he had to make a choice. Am I going to just sell out and say what the king wants to hear, or am I going to actually tell you the truth? And he's eventually going to get sawed in half by Hezekiah's son Manasseh. And so he's going to end up dying because he wouldn't sell out and become just fake media, if you want a contemporary illustration. So he is prophesying. And so anyway, he, in the last days, he's now projecting into the future, not talking about the current situations. Watch this. The mountain of the Lord's temple. Now, the mountain of the Lord's temple is Mount Moriah. It's just that north part, right of the king, north of the David's palace. It rises up, and we can show you that. It's on your in back of your Bibles. You've got maps of it. The mountain of the Lord's temple will be established, meaning it's going to be set up. It's going to be redeveloped. It's going to be built up as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. So this is talking here potentially, and I can show you in Zechariah definitely, a topographical change. It's going to be lifted up. It's not just going to be established politically. It's going to be moved. It's going to be some kind of an elevation is going to take place. Unless we're just going to make everything figurative, and that just means it's going to be a very important city. But yeah, you're still talking about a place on earth. And are you really literally talking about Jerusalem being a very important place someday in the future? Well, not really. It's just a metaphor for the place in heaven. So in other words, you reduce it from an actual topographical change where the mountains are going to be shifted. There's going to be an earthquake involved. It's going to be lifted up, and it's an actual place. You're going to change it from, well, that's not going to take place. It's just an important city. Well, it's not really even a city. It's all spiritual. It's far, far away in heaven, and this means nothing in what it says. So, I mean, that's your switching from millennial teaching of a millennial kingdom to what we'd say is an amillennial teaching, and this is something you can do. People do it in what we'd say good churches all the time. They don't take this literally. They just, spiritualize it, and there's not going to be the mountains are not going to change. It's not really going to be Jerusalem. It's just in a far, far away place, heaven. Then it says, now that this has been changed, then it says, many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And this is many peoples refers to the Gentiles. This is a theme throughout the book of Isaiah. Even Paul's teacher, Gamaliel, used this chapter, or used these verses in Isaiah to teach his students. And he wasn't a Christian, he's just teaching that God is going to reach the Gentiles. He is not just the God of the Jews. They are the chosen people, but he's going to use the Jews to reach all the Gentiles. Gamaliel, a Jew, was teaching this. And it's interesting that his disciple, Paul, became a disciple of, or an apostle of the Lord Jesus Christ, and took that very message to the Gentiles. Almost like Gamaliel prepped Paul, or Saul, for what Jesus was going to do with them. But it's not radical. And watch, many peoples will come and say, come, let's go to the mountain, this place right here, in the future, the distant future, to the house of the God of Jacob. He, the Lord, who's now living and dwelling here, remember, you've got God the Father, and then you've got the Son, you've got the wisdom, you've got this other, the seed of the woman, the seed of David. He's now here, the Messiah. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. Remember, teach us his ways. He's in Proverbs, he's the one crying in the streets, portrayed as a woman crying in the streets, compared to the corrupt woman who's crying in the streets for, adultery or something, or a prostitution. This is wisdom crying out, come and learn of me. Now that is personifying wisdom and inheritance, same thing. The nations will stream to him. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. Now understand, if this, and again, if you're going to spiritualize this, you've got to keep up with every line and keep spiritualizing this to what it means really. But if you let it mean what it says, it means that in the future days, this city is going to be lifted up. It's going to be raised up, a change. The Lord Christ, the King, is going to dwell here. He's going to live here. And because he's the Creator, he's the Lord, he's got all the wisdom, he's going to make Israel, it's going to become a very prosperous place. And the nations are going to be coming from all around the world to meet with him, not to ask him, now get this, for knowledge. Not trivia questions. They're not like, you know, what's, you know, the square root of, and ask him all these, you know, it's like, they're going to come, and they're, if you want to ask, figure this out, they're going to come and ask him basically political questions. How do we fix our economy? How do we improve our agriculture? Just like Solomon was a foretaste of this, where the Queen of Sheba and others came and asked him questions. They took his wisdom back and implemented it. He's going to take this nation and make it great again. And they're going to come and say, how did you do this? And they're going to go back home with the information. The wisdom of the Lord will be then, well, the knowledge of the Lord will fill the earth. That we see that's in there. And that's where he's going to sit here and he's going to teach and share. He's going to give them good political, economic, institutional, educational advice. And they're going to go back and again, Solomon did that as an example. Then, not only, and again, remember we talked about nations. He's going to judge the nations. There's a difference between judging the nations, evaluating them, and just destroying the whole concept of nations. He's not going to get rid of nations. He's going to judge them. Some are going to be sent away. Some are going to be restored, but there's going to be nations in his kingdom. And he will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. So one of the things they're going to be coming at him is with peace negotiations. It's like, we've been at war with these people for thousands of years or hundreds of years. We've got this, and he's going to then begin to resolve it. And he's going to give them answers for their their international disputes. They, in response, will beat their swords into plowshares, and you know this verse, and their spears into pruning hooks, because they no longer need weapons to defend themselves, because the Lord has resolved all their issues. They can now take all of their military production and turn it into agricultural production. Why? Because they got to stay in business. No, because this wisdom, he is also doing things like removing the curse from the earth. We're going to see that later. He's also going to, if you want it, I've written this other place before, and you can read the verses. He's going to increase the sunlight. The sunlight is going to increase. You talk about global warming. It seems like he's going to actually increase global warming. I don't know how all it's going to come together, but it's going to be so productive that they no longer need military weapons because he's resolved all their issues. But they're going to now take all their manufacturing and convert it into agriculture, because not just to stay in business, but because we need more farming equipment. Well, right here. They'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And that's a poetic way of saying it. But think about it actually. I mean, they've stopped war, and we've increased agriculture. We need more agriculture equipment. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, O house of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord. And there, right there in verse 5 is Isaiah saying, this is what's going to happen. This is just like Psalm 2 talks about, kiss the son lest he be angry, meaning he is going to rule, though he is going to be Lord. Let's follow him today. Isaiah is saying the same thing. This is the way it's going to be. When the Lord is ruling and reigning, all these nations are going to come and get advice. He's going to resolve all their disputes. Agriculture is going to boom. It's going to be the glorious, most glorious time in history. So with that knowledge, let's follow him today. You know, and that's kind of Isaiah's point. And it goes on and says, you have abandoned your people, O house of Jacob. You have abandoned your people, O the house of Jacob. And there it goes through and talks about all the things that they've done wrong. And there is now the separation that's being said, and this is going to come up throughout the book. This is the future, but as far as right now, Israel's going to be judged and taken into dispersion, and eventually there's going to be a little revival here in Judah, but then the Babylonians are going to come and take them into captivity. So it's not going to work, just like we've said before, because of man's nature, all this good advice, they can't process it. Go to chapter 4, please, of Isaiah. Here we go. Isaiah 4, beginning in verse 1, it says, "In that day, seven women will take hold of one man and will say, 'We will eat our own food and provide our own clothes, only let us be called by your name, take away our disgrace.'" And in other words, that's a day where there's going to be destruction and they need a man because all the men have been, there's been such disaster. But then it goes on and says, "In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel." So it's almost like there's a day coming when there's going to be this loss. There's going to be a disaster. And to the place where men are rare and the women will try and find a man. We need a man. But then after that, the branch of David will arise and there's going to be survivors. And so this is almost sounding like a terrible time, but immediately after that terrible time, the branch of David will arrive and solve the problem. This time could be not 722 or, you know, sometime during the Babylonian destruction, but it could be the tribulation that we're going to talk about. And it goes on and says, "In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel. Those who are left in Zion, who remain in Jerusalem, will be called holy, and all who are recorded among the living in Jerusalem. The Lord will wash away the filth of the women of Zion. He will cleanse the bloodstains from Jerusalem by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of fire. Then the Lord will create over the mountain of Zion, Mount Zion, and over those who assemble there, a cloud of smoke by day and a glow of flaming fire by night. Over all the glory will be a canopy. It will be a shelter and a shade from the heat of the day and a refuge and a hiding place from the storm and the rain." Again, that's talking about potentially, it sounds like, the millennium. And notice the survivors, he's going to come and begin to rebuild that. So we're not going to build a lot on that, but it feeds into the whole concept of a terrible time for Jacob, survivors, and the Lord coming and putting his presence there. Chapter 7. Now, we should do this as we go by this. Chapter 6, just so you can see this. Chapter 6 is Isaiah's calling, and you know this. People use this all the time. But this is just his calling of what he's going to do. So chapter 6, verse 1, this is not to do with what we're talking about, that except this is Isaiah's calling. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw," and you can see that would be right around 740. So you get this in picture. I was saying this. Northern Israel is going to fall in 722. This is 740. This is the end of Amos, Amos's time. Hosea's prophesying. So this is right here when he begins to prophesy. So he's going to prophesy during these years before northern Israel, and then he's going to continue to prophesy down into the 600s during the days of Judah's recovery and decline again. Nonetheless, that's when that's taking place. He says, "I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple." Now, is this a vision of heaven, or is he in the temple precincts, and he's seeing a vision there? And his train filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with six wings, and talks about that. "Holy, holy, holy," they're saying, "the whole earth is full of his glory." In the concept there, but ultimately it's going to be manifested. "At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. Woe to me, I cried, I am ruined," because he is seeing God. He's in their word. It's one thing to worship God and go through the rituals, but it's another thing to actually see God manifested, and he realized, this is not good news for me. "For I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord," or their Yahweh Almighty. So, you know, it's that whole idea, no one's ever seen God. And we know from New Testament teaching and Jesus teaching that what they've seen is the second member of the Trinity. But now he's seeing a manifestation of God, and he's very concerned. Then one of the seraphs came down, touched him with a coal from the altar of incense and purified his lips. Then I heard a voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" Again, notice that word "us." Now, who is us? Is that God and the angelic hosts on his side? Is that, you know, Yahweh and that son, the wisdom, the seed of the woman, the Christ? I mean, you know, that's all debatable. Or is it, some people say that's the majestic us. It's still one God, but he doesn't just call himself me because he's so important. He calls himself us. We, me. Anyway, who will I send? Who will we send? Who will go for us? And I said, "Here am I, send me." He said, now here, this is just interesting. This is who he's being sent to. He's being sent to the people of this time period. What were the people of this time period like? He said, "Go and tell this people, be ever hearing, but never understanding. Be ever seeing, but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused, make their ears dull, and close their eyes. Otherwise they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed." Then I says, "For how long, O Lord?" And he says, "Until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant." And he talks about the destruction. So in other words, it's almost like saying, I'm sending you, and the word is going to be so bright, so loud, that any kind of hearing, any kind of sense, the light or truth that they've got, it's going to be so bold, it's going to be so prominent that they're just going to close completely. They're going to shut down. And it's like the final stages of a culture is the word is going to go through and it's going to shut the people down. And they're going to reject all that he's got to say. And again, like I've said before, what a depressing ministry. You know, I'll go. Who will go for us? I'll go. Okay, well, here's what's going to happen. No one will be able to understand anything you're saying, but go. And it's like, what a lousy... So in other words, Isaiah did not have a mega church. No one came. No one understood what he was saying. Now, chapter 7 goes into this, and this now is Ahaz. This is Hezekiah's father. After Ahaz comes the good king, Hezekiah. And then after Hezekiah comes Hezekiah's son, Manasseh, who, again, is a terrible king. He's going to reign, is it 52 years? I can't say it right. Something like that. But his last 50 years of complete wickedness, but his last 2 years, he's going to, because between year 43 and 50, he's going to be taken to Babylon as a captive. Had a ring put through his jaw and, you know, taken in chains to Babylon and put in prison. And there he repents and is restored. And for his last 2 years, he begins to fortify Jerusalem and try to rebuild the city. And that's where his son is rebellious, but he's got a grandson named Josiah. And he kind of wonder, Josiah was, you know, 7 years old during these last 2 years. And Manasseh, yeah, the Bible does not say, but as a grandfather, it's fun to think about. He may have had, his son was lost. I mean, you know, he was a lost cause. But Josiah looks like he maybe learned something from his grandfather. Manasseh, who's the most wicked king in the Bible, but the last 2 years he tried to recover. So I would anticipate Manasseh is one of those people that is in heaven today, not because he was a good guy, but because he came back. Anyway, we're talking to Ahaz right now. And this is an interesting chapter. You know this chapter. When Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, the king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram, and Pekah of Remaliah, or son of Remaliah, was king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. Now, what's taking place right here is this is right out of the days of Hosea. Again, we got Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. You've got Aram up here, and you've got Pekah, son of Remaliah, as the king of northern Israel. This is during that series of assassinations. They're killing each other. They had like five assassinations. So he's nobody. He's no. That's why they call him Son of Remaliah. He's got no dynasty. He's nobody. He's just an assassin that came in and took the throne. But anyway, the king up here of the Arameans and the king of Israel, they united and came against Ahaz, the king of Judah, the son of David. He's in the line of David. And Isaiah comes to him. And again, it's a long story. He says, "Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim." Aram has allied itself with Ephraim. Ephraim's a name for the northern 10 tribes. It's one of the tribes. "So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind." You know, it's Canada and Mexico have united against, you know, Trump or whatever, you know, the United States. And the people are like, okay, China and Russia have conspired and sent the COVID and or whatever. But they're shaken. Their whole nation is shaken because these guys have come to war against Ahaz because they want Ahaz to go along with them in rebellion against the rising power of the Assyrians. Remember, in 760, Jonah's time, the Assyrians were weak. I mean, collapsed. And they are going to recover by 740. Tiglath-Pileser is marching, and he's rebuilding everything. The whole infrastructure, everything, the military, how things are done. He's rebuilding it, and they're gaining in power so much so that by 722, they're going to destroy Israel completely, beginning with a 725 invasion. So they're in the midst of the rise, and the Arameans and Israel think, we got to stop this, and we need help. So they want Ahaz to come down and help them. He's not cooperating. "Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out," now watch this, "go out, you and your son, Shir Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field." Now this is in the Christian quarters, and you can go up this old hotel called the Petra Hotel. You can look down and see the water reservoir that was in existence at the time. The Petra Hotel is kind of cool. It's very old today, but it's where Mark Twain stayed in the 1800s when he went over and wrote the book. He stayed in this hotel. It was one of the luxurious ones. I've got some video, and I went up there, and you can stand up on the top of the balconies up there, and you can look down and you can see this place, and it's in the middle of the city. It doesn't look like much. In 2007, it's all full of garbage, just full of garbage. It looks like a dump. By 2010, 2012, they'd cleaned it out, and I'm not sure why they cleaned it out, but it's large. But nonetheless, this is where they met. It was outside the walls of Jerusalem at that time on the north side. And he goes up to meet Ahaz. Ahaz might have been up there inspecting the water supply as the king because he's got people invading him. Remember, his son Hezekiah is going to cut Hezekiah's tunnel to connect the Gihon Springs to the Pool of Siloam because they got to get the water into the city. So he's probably up here inspecting this, wondering, what am I going to do? Do we have a water source if these guys come against the city? So Isaiah goes up to meet him there, and God says to him, "Say to him, be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid." I mean, don't make a rash decision. Just stay calm and think, because you have no need to be afraid. "Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood." What are the two smoldering stubs of firewood? They're over there in verse chapter 7, verse 1. "King Rezin of Aram and Pekah, son of Remaliah." So this is Rezin and this is Pekah. Two smoldering stubs of firewood, meaning they're about burned out. If you just step back and watch them, the last few flames are going to take them out. There's not much left of these guys. "Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and of the son of Remaliah." It doesn't even say Pekah. Just calls him son of Remaliah, which is emphasizing you are a son of David. He's a son of Remaliah. I mean, we've got an eternal covenant with David in your household. Remaliah's son, I don't even know his name, but it's not important. He's a burning out stub. Then he says, verse 5, "Aram Ephraim and Remaliah's son. So this land, the land of Ephraim and Pekah, Remaliah's son, have plotted your ruin, saying, let us invade Judah, let us tear it apart and divide it among ourselves and make the son of Tabeel king over it. So Isaiah says, here's what they're planning on doing. They're planning on invading your land, killing you, then taking the land and dividing it up into portions, and they even name the guy that's going to be the king. They're going to replace the son, one of the sons of David, with the guy named, and you never know this name because you never hear it, son of, make the son of Tabeel king over it. Well, who is the son of Tabeel? We don't know his first name. He's the son of Tabeel. Another no name is going to be the king. So this foreign, this Gentile nation, this son of Remaliah, is going to come and attack the king from the seed of from the tribe of David, and is going to divide the kingdom and put someone else in charge of it. So now that's news for him. It's like this exactly was going to, that could freak him out. So he goes, yet this is what the sovereign Lord says. That's what they say. This is what the sovereign Lord says. It will not take place. It will not happen. Meaning that plan is not going to happen. That's their plan. But don't worry about it. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is only Rezin. So you got this whole country, and the country's the head of the country is Damascus, but the head of Damascus is Rezin. I mean, it's just a man, a smolder. This kingdom is nothing because the city is run by a man who's nothing. There's nothing here to worry about. He's trying to give him some logic. Then he says, watch this. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be too shattered to be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. So he says 65 years. Now you can do this right here. If this is 740, say, and you had 65 years, you understand how far this is going. Okay, help me out here. You got that? What's the number? 75, okay. By 675 B.C., is that right? 10, 14, yes, okay. This right here, this is not going to be people. This is not going to be people. This is all going to be gone. In fact, by 722, this is going to be controlled by the Assyrians. And they're going to have brought in Gentiles from all these other countries. This is going to be occupied by Gentiles, which is important because this is going to become the land of the Gentiles, which is going to be a land living in darkness because the truth is gone. Gentile religions have come in, and this is where the Messiah is going to come from when he comes from the land of the Gentiles, a land in darkness. A light is going to come. Isaiah is going to say that. So now that's 765. Okay, now remember, that was 65 years. Are you with me on this at all? Is this? Yeah. Okay, now it says, okay, then he says, the head of, okay, if you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. In other words, Ahaz, if you don't trust this word, you have nowhere to go. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz. In other words, that's the word. Now he's going to ask him. This is important right here. Then the Lord spoke to Ahaz through the prophet Isaiah. Ask Yahweh, your God, for a sign. Whether the deepest depths or the highest height. Now Hezekiah is going to do the same thing. Isaiah is going to ask Hezekiah when he's on his deathbed. He says, what sign do you want to have? He says, do you want the sun to go forward or backwards? And he says, we'll make it go backwards. And so God gave him a sign, and he knew that he was going to recover. Same thing taking place with his father. He says, ask for a sign, whatever you want. I guarantee this is what's going to happen. Now I'll give you a sign to prove that what I've said to you is the Lord's asked me for something. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put Yahweh to the test. And whatever that means, it doesn't please Isaiah. I mean, he wanted him to ask for something to confirm this. But Isaiah said, hear now, you house of David. Now he calls him house of David. Now he is now representing the house of David, but he's in rebellion. I mean, the house of David, you would expect more from the house of David. Is it not enough to try the patience of men? In other words, he's mocking Isaiah, the prophet. Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The Lord himself will choose the sign. And he says, now here's your verse. the virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. Now, we know, and we'll look at Matthew, we know this is used in Matthew to refer to the birth of Jesus. But really, if it's true and it's impressive, what good was it for this? It's like, I'll give you a sign. I'm going to give you a sign then. In 675 years, no. In 740 years, a child is going to be born. The Messiah is going to be born. It's like, wow, that was useful. I mean, what, he's never going to, who's going to see? So that there is, this is one of those prophecies that's true, because we're going to see that in Matthew. But now, this has to apply to this time. This has to apply to 740. It's got to fit here. You would think. The virgin will be a child and will give birth to him and will call him Emmanuel. Now, notice right here, Emmanuel, it means God with us. So it's talking about God coming and being with them. Now watch this. This child, verse 15, he will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. So what he's saying is this child is going to be born. Okay, you ready? We had 65. It's just 675. But now he says, okay, I'll up it. He says, by the time this child knows enough to do what's right and wrong, now that would be 12 years old, all right, the land of the Arameans and the land of the Israel, or northern Israel. Now we're going to take 12, that's 30, that's 7, 28. Is that correct? So now, and that's about the time, by that time, the Arameans were gone. And this land was now, and we know this from Hosea, by 728, the name of the king is Hoshea, and he is paying major tribute to the Assyrians. Assyria is controlling this. All that's left is the city, and Hoshea is going to go down to Egypt to try and get help. He's in complete confusion, and he's going to be taken captive in 725, and the final city is going to be taken out in 722. So instead of being 65 years, he says, okay, God will give you a sign. He says, the child, he's going to eat curds. He's going to eat the good of the land. He'll be eating the good of the land, but by the time he knows what's wrong and right, he says, these two lands of these two kings that you fear will be totally laid waste. Let me bring you look enough to know. Okay, but before the boy knows, I'm in verse 60, knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. The Lord will bring on you and your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria, that's Tiglath-Pileser. In that day, the Lord will whistle for flies from the distant streams of Egypt and for bees from the land of Assyria, and they will all come and settle in the steep ravine and in the crevices in the rocks, on all the thorn bushes and in all the water holes. In that day, the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the river, the king of Assyria, to shave your head and the hair of your legs and to take off your beards. In other words, and you can read all that. He says, because you're going to do this, they're going to come down, and the Assyrians are going to come, the Egyptians are going to come, take these people out, and they'll end up taking and shaving everything off of you. And that's where you find Hezekiah, because Ahaz, instead of listening to Isaiah, asking for a sign and having confidence, and just staying firm, staying calm, don't take any action. When Isaiah leaves him, Ahaz does this. He goes up and meets with Tiglath-Pileser, says, we'll pay you tribute. Will you attack these people? It's like he was going to attack them anyhow. But he pays him and says, we'll be your subject if you protect me. The Lord tells him, tells through Isaiah, the Lord is going to take care of you. But because you won't listen, you won't ask for a sign, you're going to do it your own way. You're going to go up and make a treaty. These people are going to be laid waste, but you're going to be stuck with the bill. You don't even need to pay for this. He's going to provide a service and you're going to pay for it. Now, again, we can read on and talks about this, but there's an example of Isaiah talking specifically, and none of this has to do with eschatology. You say, why did you waste all your time? Well, one reason we can waste our time on this is that was in a prophecy, and it was fulfilled historically. Click, click, click. The numbers are all here. The nations are all gone. The Assyrians came in, and it all happened literally the way it takes place. But what we have that verse. Now, let's go to, where is it at? It's in Matthew chapter 1. Please go there. Because here's an example, and you know this verse because we read it every Christmas. Do you understand that verse? That verse. Oh, I got to read the next chapter too. That verse talking about this son that's going to be born. It takes place in this time right here. And again, I'm using 740 to get to 728. It may not be exactly 740. It may be sometime in that. So, I mean, we could adjust that number, and it may come out exactly 722. But it started happening in 728, and it's not before 740. So this takes place literally, and it does say the word virgin, it means a young maiden. A young woman is going to have a child. Now, in Matthew, the word can also be used, and this is the way they interpret it, chapter 1. I'm looking for, right here, go to verse 22. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet, that'd be Isaiah, the virgin, and again, there's the word, it's Alma, it will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. And Matthew clearly sees that this, because of what was said before, you got the angel speaking and being this would be born of the Holy Spirit, and he'll sit on the throne of his father David. That's all in the verse right up there before. He'll be God with us. And when Joseph woke up, he did what the angel says, and it said, did not have union with her until she gave birth to a son. In other words, clearly this was the Son of God. It was not a natural born. And so they take this verse and they bring it into the future, not eschatologically, again, into the future. And again, it is in a sense eschatological because of the end times. And that's just an example of a verse. Go back to Isaiah. And this, I can show you probably the actual fulfillment of this child. I mean, the literal, maybe in chapter 8. The Lord said to me, Isaiah, chapter 8 of Isaiah, verse 1, take a large scroll and write on it with an ordinary pen. Write Maher, Shalel, Hash, Bash, and I will call in Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah as reliable witnesses for me. Then, in other words, he goes in and he's a prophet. And he can write. We know he can write. And he writes on a pen, on a scroll. They're going to seal it up. They're going to watch it. And they're going to document it. They're going to seal it so it can't be broken. They'll make two copies probably. So one's sealed and one's a copy showing you what is on the sealed document. So you don't have to open up to see it. And then what he does, and then right there, you can see what that name means. If you look down your footnotes, Maher Shalah Hashbash means quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. In other words, it's not going to be 65 years. It's going to be quick. It's going to be 12 years. Because then he goes, after he gets, as the two priests watch him write this down, and he says, this is what I'm going to name my son. Quick to the plunder, quick to the spoil, seal it. And then, chapter 8, verse 3, then I went to the prophetess, that would be his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to a son, and the Lord said to me, name him Mahershala Hashbash, before the boy knows how to say my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria will be carried off by the king of Syria. And that would be, that takes place in 732. Is when the wealth was taken away and Samaria was not destroyed, but all their gold, we read it in the Chronicles, of everything was taken away, or 2 Kings. Anyway, there it goes right here. And then the Lord spoke to me again, because this people has rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh and rejoices over Rezin and the son of Remaliah. And so he's chewing them out for not listening to the prophecy of chapter 7. Nonetheless, that's interesting, and I hope you like it. Chapter 9, verse 1. Nevertheless, after all of this, it says, chapter 9, verse 1. Now, this is about a child also. And again, it's a Christmas verse. But all that is taking place. Chapter 7 and 8 is all talking about this culture right here. But hanging in there is that the prophecy about Emmanuel, yet in the future. Matthew picks up on it. Chapter 9, verse 1. Nevertheless, even though this is happening, nevertheless, there's something more is going to happen. There will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. Now, what is the land of Zebulun and Naphtali? Those are two tribes, and you know where those two tribes are located? Those two tribes are located right up here. This is in the north up here, Zebulun and Naphtali. They're the northern tribes of these 10 tribes of Israel. They're the first ones to be overrun by an invasion from the north. And so, again, remember, this became the land of the Gentiles. Because Ahaz didn't listen and these guys are in rebellion, this is going to be overrun by the time Maher, Shalah, Hashbash does. Okay. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. Now, Isaiah's, if this is in the same time period, this hasn't even happened yet. He's just prophesying. He may be going back and now talking about now that this has happened. He may be writing this later and just putting it in this place. But nonetheless, this is going to be overrun and it's going to be humbled. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, now this is what we're interested in the future, not in this day, these people are all going into captivity and dispersion. In the future, he will honor Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea along the Jordan. And how? Because the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. This is going to become the land of the Gentiles. And the darkness is the religions and the culture of the Gentiles. But this land of the Gentiles is going to see, it's the land of Israel, but it's occupied by Gentiles. In that day, in the day of Jesus, it's going to be occupied by Romans and all the people dispersed. There's going to be Samaritans that are part Jewish, part Gentile. It's all dispersed. This is Judah's trying to, they're trying to be pure. These people are all just mixtures of Roman soldiers and Samaritans and Gentiles and traders coming in and out. But they'll be honored because in the land of darkness, they have seen a great light. And that great light is going to be Jesus. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, where the Assyrians came, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you. Now notice, that was fulfilled when Jesus was born in Bethlehem, went to Egypt. He then came back and grew up in Nazareth, which is right here, right on the north side of the Jezreel Valley, right in the land of Naphtali and Zebulun. Right here is where that's where he grows up. That's where he's going to perform his miracles. That's where the scribes and the Pharisees come out of Judea, out of Jerusalem, to come up here to see, what is this magician doing? What is going on here? And they began to question. Many of them became believers. This is where he fed the thousand. This is where the Gentiles were fed. And this is, they're seeing the Messiah. They're seeing a great light. In other words, right in there is, God is going to destroy this land, but he's also going to send this land the Messiah. Once again, you have the Gentiles playing into that. You've enlarged the nation, increased their joy. They rejoice before you. A people rejoice at harvest, as men rejoice while dividing the plunder. For as in the days of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke, the burden that was on them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. So there's going to be some deliverance. Now it goes on, says, they were talking about Christ. Now again, you've got not a problem, but this is something the Jews struggle. You understand this, but the Jews struggled with this because you've got a child is being born, in the future, and that's going to be Christ, who's going to become the suffering servant here later on in Isaiah, but yet there's going to be a kingdom that he's going to establish. And so we have no trouble as Christians, we have no trouble seeing Jesus came and died on the cross and went to heaven saying, I'll come back, and we're waiting for him to come back and establish his kingdom. In these verses, those events are like this. It's the Christ, and he's going to come. There's going to be a bright light that's going to shine here. Well, that was Jesus when he was born and grew up and then began ministering here. Then he goes to Jerusalem and dies and ends up in heaven. Well, they continue talking about what he's going to do to this land and all the prosperity and the greatness. It's like none of that happened. It was overrun by the Romans and dispersed again. Well, it jumps right into his second coming. You understand why the Jews were confused? Because you're talking about his first coming. The land has seen a bright light, and there's the burden's been broken. There's no the verse 5. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, for us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. I mean, you understand? You got the child is born, and you can see why Mary and the angel, he almost wants to say, come on, make it clear for the poor girl. I mean, she's this young girl, she's going to have, he says, your son is going to sit on the throne of David. Yeah, this is going to be awesome. And he ends up dying on the cross. And it's like, what happened? And it's like, how this? And she even went to take him away because he's supposed to be building an army. You know the story. Getting his warriors ready. And there were people ready for a Messiah. And he's up here sitting on the sides of the mountains teaching and on the plains teaching and feeding people and trying to explain the scriptures to people and arguing with the Pharisees, talking to demons. It's like, wait, okay, you're off track. The angel clearly said, you're supposed to sit on the throne of David. And he's not, even that, because right here it says it. And you can see how we have no trouble because we can see the divide. But you can see the struggle, especially look at these verses. Now, I'll say this too. Did Isaiah see it clearly? Did Isaiah understand it clearly? We can go to 2 Peter, where Peter writes, the prophets long to look into these things. So, well, you want to hear it? I'm going to go to 2 Peter. I think it's in 2 Peter. Is it 2 Peter? It's either 2 or 1 Peter. Oh, yeah, chapter 1, 1 Peter. Chapter 1, verse 10. Concerning this salvation, the prophets spoke of the grace that was to come to you. They searched intently. I'm in chapter 1, verse 10. The prophets, like Isaiah, searched intently and with the greatest care, trying to find out the time and circumstances in which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. It was revealed to them, not that, but what was revealed to them, that they were not serving themselves, but you. In other words, we're talking about the suffering, like Isaiah's talking about and is going to continue to talk about, and the glories that would follow. It's like, okay, when's that all take place? And the answer says, it's not for you to know. You're not serving yourself. You're writing these things down for someone else. So it's possible that Isaiah's bunching these verses together, and he himself is saying, okay, now, once the child is born and the Assyrians come in, then when does the glory come? It's like, well, first of all, the Messiah's got to come first. And that's in the future. Okay, well, then when does the glory come? Well, that's in the future too. It's not for you to know. You just write it down, Isaiah. So it's like, why didn't Isaiah make this clear? Because right here, I think, at least it's possible, he may have been trying, looked intently, that they it was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but you, when they spoke of the things that have now been told to you by those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, even angels long to look into these things. In other words, the things Isaiah was writing, even angels are going, yes, what is it? And they're trying to piece it. So even the script, the fact that it's almost in a mystery form, Isaiah may not have, well, some prophet didn't understand it. Some prophets, I've got some questions. Daniel had questions. How will this be? Angel says, go your way, Daniel. So you've got examples of the angel saying, we're not going to tell you. Because even angels were looking at wanting these things answered. And so the fact that the Jews didn't understand it, I mean, you understand, we are at an advantage. We still got questions. And you're going to disagree with things I present because we still don't know exactly. But we can see clearly, this was a time period where Isaiah was talking to Ahaz and the people of his day, and they're going to be overrun by the Assyrians. We also know that the Messiah was going to come here to this land that was overrun by the Assyrians, the Gentiles, and be a bright light shining to these people. And that there's going to be some glory. It's going to be the nation was going to be increased and enlarged, but that wasn't 30 AD because it was overrun and destroyed by 70 AD. And so all of a sudden, half those prophecies are yet eschatological. Now, once again, to close, is this literal? Is this millennial? Or is it amillennial? It's not really going to happen like this. Well, did these kings actually live? Were they actually overrun like Isaiah said? Yes. Well, did the light actually come to Nazareth? Was there actually a man came to this land named Jesus? Yes, he actually came. Well, was the land actually enlarged? Well, no, the Romans destroyed it. Well, if he came to this land, if this land was overrun by the Assyrians, according to the prophecy, if the Messiah came to this land in the Gospels, what land, what kingdom do you think is going to be enlarged? Well, far, far away in heaven. Well, it's got to be here. I mean, the Assyrians came, Jesus came, and when we fulfill it, where's it got to take place? Unless you're going to just completely destroy the context of Scripture, it's got to be Jerusalem, the land of Israel, the Abrahamic covenant, the land, the city, the seed of David. Okay, I've got to quit. We are in. We didn't get done with chapter 7, but you can see right there, this is, you know, stay with me. And I think it's important because when you start reading Thessalonians and Revelation, seeing Jesus talk, those guys are all, they're not just jumping out in the deep water to start telling you stuff. They're building on this kind of, even the angel says, you know, he's building on the throne of David, the seed of David. They're building on these things. And so it just makes it safe. So I'll quit now and I'll pray and then you're free to go. If you have any questions, you can ask me a question or make a correction. Because like I say, this is confusing. I always want to move faster. I'd like to stay and talk for another 4 hours and just finish the book of Isaiah. But of course, you would never come back. And I wouldn't blame you. I'll pray. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to look into your word. We ask that we again would handle this correctly. We would understand it. We do thank you again for the opportunity to meet at this time in history in this country. And we pray for our nation. We pray for our churches and ask that we may see revival, that we may have an opening of our hearts, that we may hear and understand what you're doing, and that we may respond as a people to your grace. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.